Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. So, to set the scene, let me frame this picture for you. Let's head back to simpler times of the late 1980s and early 1990s. Our tale tonight spans a number of years in the not-too-distant past, but long enough ago that the world has moved on immensely. A time when George Bush, the first one, was the President of the United States. Before both Gulf Wars and 9/11. Before the Berlin Wall came down and before anyone had ever heard of the internet. When Wilson Phillips and Sinead O'Connor were the biggest selling musical artists, and Michael Keaton's Batman ruled the box office. What a time to be alive.
It's not supposed to happen in Beverly Hills. A movie executive and his wife were brutally slain in their million-dollar mansion.
As I went into the room, I just started firing.
What was in front of you?
My parents.
The question is not whether Lyle or Eric Menendez killed their parents. After all, they admitted that they did, under oath. Instead, the focus of the case has always long been about why the brothers did what they did. They claim they killed their mother and father out of fear for their own lives, and in an act of self-defense following a lifetime of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Abuse which they alleged they suffered at the hands of their parents. But are things that simple? Tonight we'll take a look at the case that after nearly 30 years is very much back in the headlines. It was a crime that sent shockwaves throughout the United States. A wealthy movie mogul and his wife murdered in their million-dollar mansion. The killers, their very own sons. The case captivated the United States and beyond, and it made Eric and Lyle Menendez household names. Through two trials that spanned across 6 years, the nation was gripped as their story played out daily on court TV, at a time when extreme reality TV was top of the ratings. OJ, Jerry Springer, the daytime talk shows that tackled fringe elements within society, it all made for macabre viewing. Following the second trial, the brothers were both sent to prison for the remainder of their natural lives and without the possibility of parole. And that was that. The story was over. Or was it? So now it seems, after more than 30 years, the brothers are back in the news. A new generation of supporters have emerged on social media, in part due to the discovery of explosive new evidence that could potentially set the brothers free. Strap in as we take a wild ride through one of the most infamous cases of the 1990s.
We are here looking out on a familiar vista, a vista of Los Angeles, because the city of Beverly Hills has been rocked by a drama at once riveting and chilling. It was nearly a year ago that one of this town's most ambitious, charming, promising new executives and his wife were savagely murdered in their home, a murder so strange, everyone searched the dark byways of movie fiction for explanations, until the prosecutor said that he had the darkest explanation of all, and he charged the two sons with the crime. Tonight, we are going to bring you a two-part report on that murder in Beverly Hills. A story and an investigation that is filled with all the contradictions of human nature. A story that evokes the irresistible themes of a Hollywood plot.
The date was Sunday, August the 20th, 1989. And in the quiet and well-to-do house at 722 North Elm Drive in Beverly Hills, Los Angeles, a crime was about to go down that would shock the world. The house on Elm Drive, at the heart of this story, was owned by Jose Menendez, a Cuban immigrant who came to the United States in 1960 at the age of just 16. Jose attended Southern Illinois University, where he met Mary Louise Anderson, known to her friends as Kitty, who was 3 years his junior. They became close relatively quickly and were married in 1963, immediately moving to New York City. Jose would soon earn an accounting degree from Queens College, while Kitty would get a job teaching middle school. The couple's first son, Lyle, whose name is actually Joseph Lyle, was born on January 10, 1968 in New York City. Their second son, Eric Galen, was born on November 27, 1970 in Gloucester Township, New Jersey. The family had moved to the Garden State shortly after Lyle was born, with Kitty giving up her teaching position to look after her children full-time. The family now lived in Hopewell Township, and both brothers attended Princeton Day School, where they were educated until they moved to California with their family as teenagers. The reason for the move to the West Coast was because Jose had secured a very lucrative corporate executive position at International Video Entertainment in 1986. You probably know the company by its third iteration, Artisan Entertainment, which was eventually purchased by Lionsgate Entertainment in 2003. They're responsible for releasing such movies as Reservoir Dogs, The Blair Witch Project, Stir of Echoes, The Ninth Gate, Requiem for a Dream, and Vanilla Sky, amongst many, many others. So, on August the 20th, 1989, brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez, aged 18 and 21 respectively by this point, spent the day swimming and playing tennis in the grounds of their family's Beverly Hills mansion. Eric was a very talented tennis player, ranking 44th in the United States as a junior player. Lyle wasn't too shabby on the court either. Eric attended Beverly Hills High School, where some of the other students in varying grades whilst he was there included Nicolas Cage, David Schwimmer, Angelina Jolie, Monica Lewinsky, and Tori Spelling, though none were in Eric's year group or knew him at the time. Lyle, on the other hand, was a student at Princeton University in New Jersey, a place that his father had made a sizable donation of $50,000 in order to ensure that Lyle was admitted, as his grades weren't sufficient alone. They called their friend and former tennis coach Perry Berman to see if he wanted to go to the movies later that evening. But Berman was not at home when they called. When he later returned the call, Jose, the father of Eric and Lyle, told Berman that the boys were out shopping at the Beverly Center. When Lyle finally touched base with Berman at around 5 p.m, he informed him that he already had plans to attend the Taste of LA Food Festival in Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. So, Lyle invited himself and his brother along and told him that they would meet him there. The brothers intended on going to see a movie in the cinema before meeting with Berman, though. So the boys ate dinner with their parents, as they did each evening. Then they drove to the 15-screen AMC Multiplex in Century City. The cinema is still there now. I watched Martin Scorsese, The Irishman, there not so long ago. I wonder if it was in the same screen as the Menendez brothers attended. Anyway, Jose and Kitty decided to stay in that evening. It was the housekeeper's night off, so they were enjoying a relaxing summer evening at home in front of the television. So the couple relaxed in the den. Jose lays in on the luxurious sofa watching the James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me, while Kitty sat at the coffee table next to him, filling out paperwork for Eric's college application. A large bookcase surrounded the room on each wall, showcasing a library of books and dozens of first-place tennis trophies that Lyle and Eric had achieved over the years. This whole picture oozes wealth and privilege, doesn't it? Jose was in tight short shorts and a sweatshirt, while Kitty wore jogging trousers and Nike trainers, or sneakers to my American friends. Jose was eating a dish of strawberries and cream, or so the official story that has been reported by dozens of news outlets and documentary series would state. But in truth, and according to court testimony, Jose was not eating anything while sat in front of the television that night. Jose did, however, have his feet rested up on the coffee table, and he was starting to doze off. An interesting fact is that the alarm system was turned off that night because, as Kitty stated, The brothers were always setting it off by accident when they got home late. But this was even though Lyle and Eric weren't even allowed to have their own house keys, so their mother or father would have to let them into the house, also triggering the alarm when activated, so this comment from Kitty doesn't make much sense. Although I think you will come to realise why that is very shortly. At around 10 p.m, one of the residents of the neighbouring houses stated that they heard a series of firecrackers being set off in the grounds of the Menendez house, but they thought nothing of it. At around 10:20 p.m, Perry Berman, the brothers' tennis coach and friend, leaves the Taste of LA Food Festival and heads home. Lyle and Eric had not met up with him there after all. But when Berman got home, he headed straight to bed. But he received a telephone call from Lyle around 15 minutes later, asking him why he wasn't at the festival. Berman told Lyle that he had been and waited a while for them, but assumed that him and Eric weren't coming. Lyle told him that they got lost and he apologised. But then Lyle insisted that they still meet up that night because he had questions about his tennis game, he said. Berman was tired and he was really not in the mood to head back out. But Lyle said that he wasn't sure there would be a time to meet up before he had to return to Princeton later that fall, and he really wanted to meet up with Berman that night. After declining a few times, Berman eventually, though reluctantly, agreed. They confirmed plans to meet at the Cheesecake Factory on North Beverly Drive, before Lyle called back yet again to say that they better meet at their house instead because Eric needed to pick up his fake ID. Fun fact, I have also eaten at this specific Cheesecake Factory location. I'm beginning to wonder if I was channeling the Menendez brothers on my last trip to LA perhaps. Anyway, Eric wanted to join Lyle and Berman for drinks, but he was only 18, hence the fake ID. But Berman was beginning to get frustrated over the whole thing and said that he didn't want to make an extra stop and he was just going to meet them at the restaurant as originally planned. The brothers would never make the Cheesecake Factory arrangement, which is a real shame because their peanut butter cup fudge ripple cheesecake is to die for. Anyway, around 11:30 p.m, the brothers returned home to find their parents brutally murdered, viciously shot to death in their own living room. Jose and Kitty were found lifeless and mutilated by shotgun blasts. The crime scene was a literal bloodbath. It was a gruesome sight. Their parents didn't even resemble humans anymore. The detectives who were first on the scene said that this was the first murder scene that they had ever attended where they needed an umbrella. Upon discovery of the bodies, Lyle took control and dialed 911. I've got the actual call for you right here.
Beverly Hills Emergency?
Yes, police.
What's the problem? What's the problem?
Someone killed my parents.
Pardon me?
Someone killed my parents.
What? Who? Are they still there?
Yeah.
The people... What?
No.
Were they shot?
Yes, man, they were...
Were they shot?
Yes.
They were shot?
Yes.
What happened?
Stand up, man!
Is the person still there?
What happened? We have units around. What happened?
I don't know.
Who shot who?
I don't know. I came home.
You came home and found who shot?
I'm in bed.
You know what? They're still in the house, the people that did the shooting.
Okay, let me talk to Eric. Who is the person that was shot?
My mom and my dad.
Your mom and dad?
My mom and my dad.
Okay, hold on a second. Okay, we're on our way over there with an ambulance.
Okay, I gotta go. Okay.
Hello, this is police department.
Yes.
Okay, I want you to come outside. Okay, just come out the front door.
I'm gonna tell my brother.
At the time of the 911 call, a neighbor and eyewitness reported that they saw Eric Menendez curled up on the front lawn in the fetus position, hysterically crying after they made the discovery. Following the 911 call, and once law enforcement had arrived at the scene, the immediate impression was that a potential organized crime hit had occurred that night. Though it later emerged that police got this idea initially after the brothers stated that they suspected the murders were conducted by the mafia. Eric even went as far as suggesting that the trigger man was a guy named Noah Bloom, a distributor of pornographic films and a former associate of the Bonanno crime family. Bloom had met Jose Menendez on one occasion, but that was enough, it seems, for Eric to accuse him of killing his parents. Law enforcement quickly established the likely causes of death at the crime scene, autopsy evidence aside, of course. They were aware that mob hits, for the most part, were done with a single bullet to the back of the head and would never include the target's wife. There was a specific code to their methods, and thus emerges holes in the story. Never the kids, never the wife, so the mafia rule goes. For these murders, there were 14 12-gauge shotgun blasts, 6 to the head and body of Jose, and Kitty was hit with 10 shotgun blasts. The gunshots were messy and displayed clear rage in their delivery. This was not about business or organized crime. The first gunshot had been to the back of Jose's head, killing him instantly. Then a barrage of shots struck Kitty in her chest, right arm, left hip, and left leg. She was left crying, crawling, and fighting for her life on the living room floor at this point. Kitty had once been a beauty queen. Law enforcement quickly identified that all the shotgun shell casings had been removed from the crime scene, which was unusual. They also ruled out a murder-suicide after the detectives investigating conducted a number of residue tests on the bodies. The wounds and positions of the bodies also indicated that neither Jose or Kitty were involved in the firing of the murder weapons. Lyle and Eric, the Menendez brothers, were extremely distraught and shaken up by what they had found. They had lost their beloved parents in the most horrific way. Who could have done this, and why? Out of compassion, the LAPD detectives decided to skip routine chemical tests on the brothers, tests which would have seen if either of them had fired a weapon that evening. It's common practice for law enforcement to test persons at a crime scene for gunpowder residue on their arms if a shotgun or high-caliber rifle has been used in the crime. This is to quickly establish if there is a faint trace of gunpowder residue which commonly kicks back and settles on the shooter's arms. Neighbors watched in horror and disbelief as the bodies of Jose and Kitty were loaded into ambulances and taken away. How could something like this happen in their neighborhood? A quiet and peaceful place, an affluent area. Beverly Hills averages just 2 murders per year, and most definitely not usually on the same night. Side note, this perspective seems quite crazy to me. How locals consider the neighborhood quiet, safe, and without crime, whilst also acknowledging that the murder average in that area is 2 murders a year. Bizarre. Within days of the murders, detectives would hit a wall in their investigation. They couldn't find any evidence or leads to support the mafia suggestion from Eric. But it didn't take long for law enforcement to suspect and aim their sights at Lyle and Eric themselves. They just needed to find the evidence, which was proven to be pretty elusive at that point. Motive-wise, the police saw things clearly. 2 spoiled rich kids who wanted to gain access to their parents' $14.5 million fortune and a further $5 million life assurance policy from their father. And also, let's not forget that $5 million mansion that they live in, that was once home to Michael Jackson, Elton John, and Prince. Financially, the brothers wouldn't be struggling if their parents passed away, and the police knew this. So if we're going to look at Lyle and Eric as the perpetrator in this crime, we need to look at motives. We already have the financial motive standing out clear as day at this point, but let's get to know the family a little more. So, as I previously and briefly touched upon, Jose Menendez was a Cuban immigrant. He was born into an upper middle class and very wealthy family in Havana, Cuba in 1944. His family encouraged a macho and aggressive attitude in him from an early age, so that he would grow up to be a proper man in their view. Knowing this, it's really not surprising that neighbours that he grew up alongside have come out to state that he was known to be a bully and a, quote, monster as a child. When Jose was 16, the communist revolution in Cuba had swept through the country and caused widespread chaos and upheaval for many families. It was due to this that his own family sent him to live in the United States for his safety. As a teenager, Jose was a talented swimmer, something that developed his commitment, athletic prowess, and taught him focus. Jose arrived in Pennsylvania in 1960. And again, as I previously stated, he met Mary Anderson, known to friends as Kitty, when he was 19 and studying at Southern Illinois University. She was just 16 when they met. They got married soon after. So, Jose earned himself a degree in accounting from Queens College in Flushing, New York. The family, following the birth of their two sons, eventually settled in Hopewell Township, New Jersey. Jose had a very rapid career rise. He'd become an executive at Hertz, the rental car company, in a relatively short period of time. Jose was said to be ruthless and extremely hard-working, with colleagues saying that he wasn't very popular and those who knew him would avoid him. He regularly pulled 18-hour workdays and set impossible standards on others. The management structure liked Jose, however, as he wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty. He would happily deal with the tasks that other managers wouldn't. This usually meant firing people. Following Hertz, Jose moved to the record distribution company RCA, where he was responsible for signing the artists Duran Duran, the Eurythmics, and Menudo in a $30 million deal. Whilst the Eurythmics and Duran Duran are extremely well known, there's a reason why I mention the teenage boy band Menudo alongside them, and we'll come to that shortly. Incidentally, Dave Stewart, the keyboardist, producer, and all-round musician from the Eurythmics, said that Jose was extremely odd. There was something about the man that made me feel uneasy, he said. Stewart recalls how when him and Annie Lennox completed their first album under RCA and played it for the label executives, Jose Menendez exclaimed that he loved it and it made him want to be a Ghostbuster. Not really the reaction that Stewart and Lennox were hoping for or expecting. So, Menudo. Menudo are a Puerto Rican boy band that was originally formed by producer Edgardo Diaz in 1977. Since their inception, they have proven to be one of the most popular and successful boy bands in the world, particularly in Spanish and Portuguese-speaking countries. To maintain a specific image, members could be no younger than 11 and had to leave the band when they turned 18, which means, since 1977, there have been around 42 members of the band to date. It was actually where the well-known 2000s pop star Ricky Martin began his career. Well, it was Jose who introduced Menudo to the United States music market. Jose took an almost obsessive and personal interest in the group, frequently having the teenage members over to his house for dinner. This may come up again later, so put a pin in it for now. So, we know that Eric and Lyle went to the exclusive and very expensive Princeton Day School and trained to become highly ranked tennis and soccer players, although they would later drop soccer to enable them to focus on tennis as that was their greater strength. Jose was expecting a significant promotion at RCA in 1986, but when he didn't get it, he flew into a fit of rage and left the company with immediate effect. The family relocated from New Jersey to Los Angeles, where Jose Menendez secured an executive position at International Video Entertainment, which became Live Entertainment, then Artisan Entertainment, before finally being purchased by Lionsgate Entertainment in 2003. Live Entertainment Video had a distribution partnership with Carolco Pictures, who were responsible for the Rambo and Terminator franchises. At Live Entertainment, Jose was highly successful and was responsible for overseeing big profits and positive business dealings. As an example, in 1985, the year before Jose's arrival at the company, live entertainment lost $20 million. The year following Jose's arrival, and directly attributed to decisions that he made, the company turned his fortunes around and earned $8 million in profit that year. That was in 1987. The following year, in 1988, Jose doubled the profits again to $16 million. Jose's reputation had followed him from Hertz, however. He used the same practices and workplace behaviors. He was reportedly despised by his colleagues and quickly amassed quite a number of enemies in the organization due to his ruthless attitude. Colleague Roger Smith stated that Jose was a command and control freak. He would allegedly step on and backstab anyone to get what he wanted. Other than his own family, it was widely considered that Jose didn't have any other friends. He also had a deep-set embarrassment for his Cuban heritage, though with that said, he also planned to use it to his advantage and run for US Senate in Florida with a campaign message of working to free Cuba. But this was a pipe dream, or at least a long-term plan that never came to fruition. But it's clear that he was hungry for power. His wife Kitty had it all, at least to those looking from the outside. The reality was, though, that Kitty was an extremely unhappy woman who had an addiction to prescription pills and was an alcoholic to top it off. She went untreated for severe depression and attempted to take her own life on several occasions. There were three attempts that we are aware of. Kitty's mental instability began when she discovered that her husband Jose was having an affair when the family lived in New Jersey. She became severely depressed over the infidelity, even going as far as to confront the woman that Jose had been seeing in the middle of the street, although by this time Jose had already ended the affair. Kitty had originally wanted to be an actress when she first met Jose, but he soon quashed those aspirations when their children were born, and he insisted that she became a stay-at-home mother. Kitty also didn't have any friends outside of the family unit. Boredom and paranoia had wrecked her. She would call Jose at his office some days every 30 minutes just to ask what he was up to and what he wanted to eat for dinner that evening. Jose, however, entertained this behavior as he knew that he was in control of the relationship. Lyle and Eric were seemingly spoiled rotten by their parents, though they also controlled them in equal measure. Both brothers were neither independent nor were emotionally mature enough to survive on their own. Kitty completed Eric's homework and Lyle's university coursework to ensure that they achieved the standards expected. But this would prove to be counterproductive, as whilst their work would be completed to a high standard, both brothers would regularly fail exams and tests, having done no studying. By Kitty completing the boys' schoolwork, this also hid the fact that Eric was dyslexic and struggled in class, something that Eric himself kept quiet at his parents' insistence, as they perceived it as a weakness and the family could not have that. Ultimately, it did impact Eric's education, however, and he was held back a year in school, though the family hid and lied about this, again due to the embarrassment that it caused them. Additionally, and make no mistake, whilst the brothers were successful at tennis, particularly Eric, it was not their choice to play the sport. Their parents had forced them to take part and have lessons. They only came to enjoy playing it in their later teens once they became really good at it. Now, when the Menendez family first relocated to California from New Jersey in 1986, the family initially lived in Calabasas, a beautiful and very well-to-do area north of Los Angeles. The Menendez family began construction of what Jose called his dream family home. It had beautiful mountain views and was sat on 13 acres of land within an exclusive gated community. But in late August 1988, and before their dream property was even finished, the family up and left, abruptly moving to Beverly Hills and their North Elm Drive property. It seemed strange to the neighbors, not that the Menendez family were close or friendly with any, of course. But as it turns out, the Menendez family were not the perfect family after all. Lyle and Eric had got into some criminal activity earlier that summer. They had been caught undertaking what are known as hot prowls, Essentially, burglary and grand theft at two of their neighbors' residences. The thefts totaled more than $100,000 in stolen cash and jewels. You can imagine the embarrassment this caused Jose and Kitty. But more than that, it also shows the brothers' greed and willingness to easily commit criminal acts. Good old dad Jose stepped in and fixed the situation, though. A quick action to try and cover everything up. Most of the stolen items were returned to their owners, and Jose also paid back any money taken with interest to guarantee that it would not be spoken about by anyone involved. Jose also cunningly arranged for Eric to take the entire blame with police, as he was not legally an adult, so the repercussions would be far less and not permanent on his record. Additionally, as Lyle was attending Princeton, Jose did not want to jeopardize that or besmirch his character in any way, even though both brothers did actually take part in the crimes equally. Eric was sentenced to probation and was court-ordered to undergo counseling. And that was it. Dr. Jerome Oziel, a Beverly Hills child psychologist, was recommended for Eric, and he began meeting with the doctor regularly. During the whole burglary drama, and whilst Jose was trying to control the fallout, Kitty became overwhelmed by the sheer shame that she felt and had been brought on the family. What would people think? She thought. Kitty overdosed on Xanax and alcohol because of the situation and was admitted to Westlake Hospital for mental health treatment. When Jose was asked about the house move by colleagues, he told them that the family needed to get away from Calabasas as there was a bad crowd there. The house at North Elm Drive was an 8-bedroom Mediterranean-style red tile roof with large courtyard, a swimming pool, a tennis court and a guest house at the rear. It was over 9,000 square feet and previous tenants had included Michael Jackson, Elton John and Prince. The house had been listed as furnished, but Jose insisted that all furniture be removed and they decorate themselves, as he perceived buying someone else's furniture to be embarrassing in some way. Fun fact, as O.J. Simpson was heavily involved in the Hertz car rental marketing throughout the 1980s, both he and Jose had become acquainted. Jose and Kitty actually had OJ over to dinner one evening, and it was established that the North Elm Drive house was the location where, previous to the Menendez family moving in, actress Robin Greer, known for the 1980s TV series Falcon Crest, had thrown a baby shower for Nicole Brown Simpson. Simpson, of course, was OJ's ex-wife that he absolutely didn't murder. Small world. The Menendez family would live at North Elm Drive for less than a year. Craig Signorelli, the son of a television executive, quickly became friends with Eric. Signorelli was captain of the Calabasas tennis team where Eric had become the number one singles player. They bonded after they both got into a fight with a rival tennis team following a match and resulted in them both having their asses kicked, Eric being left with a broken jaw. They gave each other nicknames, namely King and Shepherd, feeling that they were something special. They enjoyed thinking they were better than the average person. They would often sit at the Overlook watching the city go by and talking about how someday they would be big shots. Signorelli described his friend Eric as, quote, both ostentatious and flamboyant. Eric would walk into a store and immediately expect staff to rush to his attention and fuss over him. If that didn't happen, he would stand up on the table and shout, "Hey, I'm here to buy something," demanding immediate attention. In both high school and amongst other members of his tennis team, there were rampant rumors that Eric was a homosexual. Eric has never confirmed or denied this rumor. Signorelli and Eric co-wrote a screenplay together titled Friends. Eric had his mother Kitty type the screenplay up professionally for them. The story was about a young man named Hamilton Cromwell who murders his rich parents so that he can obtain their wealth through inheritance. Some people say that Eric had his own mother type out her death scene for him. Eric gave a copy of the script to his photographer friend Philip Kearney to read. Kearney had become friends with Eric after Eric paid him to take sexy and scantily clad photographs of him while, it's worth adding, Eric was just 17. Kearney was impressed with the script and told Eric that as a photographer, he often photographed many celebrities, and he thought that Eric had what it takes to become a Hollywood actor. These comments fed Eric's ego for a short while, and Eric briefly showed some interest in becoming an actor or a model. Eric actually gave a well-regarded performance of a Hamlet soliloquy on one occasion during this period. But who was he kidding? Eric thought. He knew his father would never allow him to be an actor or a model. Shifting focus to the other brother now, Lyle. Just before the trouble that summer in 1988, Lyle had been suspended from Princeton University, causing huge embarrassment to his mother and father. Lyle had been caught cheating in Psychology 101 class. But it's not surprising given how his mother did most of his work and his father got him into the damn uni in the first place. It was due to his suspension that he was hanging around the LA house in the first place with Eric instead of being back on the East Coast. For a very short period of time during that summer, Lyle worked at Live Entertainment, a job that his father had got him to get him out of the house. But that didn't last very long, as Lyle was not best suited for work, and he was surprised with how measly the salary was. Many colleagues who worked alongside Lyle at Live Entertainment said that he acted like a spoiled rich kid the entire time that he was there. Entitled, opinionated and lazy, he often left work in the middle of the day to go and play tennis, while his colleagues working a similar role were not afforded the same luxury. Lyle was eventually allowed to return to Princeton after serving a one-year suspension. Following the summer of crime by the brothers, Lyle's uni expulsion, and seeing how insufferable and spoiled the boys were, Jose made plans to cut them both out of his last will and testament entirely. Jose had lost all patience with his sons, and he had no faith that they would amount to anything. In fact, Jose's brother-in-law, Carlos Barolt, testified and confirmed Jose's will plans, although he did confirm that Jose never got the opportunity to follow it through before he died. Or were those plans the reason that he died? Whilst Eric was shy and a loner, with only one or two friends, and none of them very close, Lyle was known to be a bit of a ladies' man. Jose hated this behaviour, however, and didn't approve of the older women that Lyle chose to cavort with. In fact, Jose hated some of Lyle's girlfriends so much that on one occasion, upon finding out that one of Lyle's dates had got pregnant, Jose paid for an abortion and also gave her a generous lump sum of money to disappear from his son's life altogether. She gladly accepted. And on another occasion, Jose had got talking to another of Lyle's girlfriends who came over to the house. As soon as he found out that she had aspirations to become a model, Jose immediately offered to pay for her to relocate to Europe to chase her modeling dreams and provide some generous living funds too. Once again, Lyle's girlfriend gladly accepted the offer. In the summer of 1989, whilst at home from university, Lyle decided that he would move into the guest house at the back of the property, whilst Eric remained in the main house. So, we know all about Eric and his brother Lyle. We know about Jose and Kitty, and what a dysfunctional and exceptionally unique family they were. We know that on August the 20th, 1989, that Jose and Kitty were the victims of a gruesome shock and slaying, while their sons, Eric and Lyle, were out at the cinema. So what on earth happened? Well, let's jump ahead now, fast forward a little bit if you will, to the period following the horrific murders. In the aftermath of Kitty and Jose's deaths, the brothers initially opted not to stay in the family home. It was a crime scene after all for the first few days. They chose instead to locate themselves in a number of luxury hotels in the Los Angeles area. But this was only a temporary solution, however, until they finalized the deal on two luxury condominiums at the Marina City Club Towers in Marina Del Rey. Their aunt, Marta Cano, who lived in Florida, was naturally concerned about her nephews now having to fend for themselves after losing their parents in such a horrific manner, so she immediately flew to LA to support them. She established herself at the North Elm Drive family home in the lead-up to the trial. She needn't have bothered, however, as it seems the brothers were just fine on their own, living it up with their newfound wealth even, it seems. The North Elm Drive property was not fully paid off, it had a mortgage on it. So the brothers allowed the bank to take control, and it was eventually purchased by a mystery novel writer. Fun fact, it's now actually owned by a corporate entity who rent it out for parties. And in particular bad taste, true crime parties. Although this doesn't surprise me in LA. Less than 2 weeks after the death of Jose and Kitty, Live Entertainment decided to arrange a memorial service at the Directors Guild in Hollywood with the blessing of both brothers. Eric and Lyle both spoke at the event. Their speeches spoke warmly of their parents, and they were both visibly upset and shaken up. Another funeral was held in Princeton, New Jersey, and a third in Florida. But by the third funeral, the brothers had grown bored about making speeches about their parents, and it seems they didn't even bother turning up for it. Then, within a period of less than a month since their parents' death, both Eric and Lyle hit the shops. They went on a huge spending spree with their newfound bank balance. Eric and Lyle, it seems, had been identified as the sole beneficiaries of the Menendez estate. This was something that they too were slightly surprised by. But they were now worth a cool $14 million, and that's on top of the $250,000 they each received from their father's life insurance policy. But even this wasn't enough. Both Eric and Lyle had individual copies of their father's American Express Platinum card, which they had been swiping to exhaustion. Now, I'm not sure how the law works in the United States, but this seems hugely illegal in itself to me. Using a deceased person's credit card. American listeners, reach out with your thoughts on this if you can, please. Anyway, the brothers got themselves a high-end condominium each, although they were across the hall from one another. Penthouses, of course. They paid for both apartments to be kitted out in expensive antique furniture. Lyle bought a Porsche 911 Carrera, while Eric decided to go for a more playful Jeep Wrangler. They splurged even more on a whole new wardrobe of designer clothes and a few neat little Rolex watches. Eric hired a $50,000 a year tennis coach to work on his game, whilst Lyle purchased a business in New Jersey. In particular, a Buffalo Chicken Wings fast food restaurant, for reasons best known to himself. Lyle told friends and family that his mother Kitty always wanted him to be a business owner. Although it's not clear if Mr. Buffalo's Spicy Wings in Princeton, New Jersey is what she had in mind. And that's not all. Both brothers decided to charter flights coast to coast on MGM Grandair, private jet hire. They took a New Year's skiing trip to Lake Tahoe and attended a New York Knicks basketball game where they of course purchased courtside seats on the floor. Eric also paid $40,000 for concert tickets, although as it turns out he was actually ripped off and didn't manage to get the tickets in the end. Although I cannot imagine who the artist was. Who would you pay that amount of money to see? Even by today's standards, that kind of money for a concert seems obscene. But I digress. The brothers, it seemed, were restless, desperate to secure happiness by spending, spending, spending. But it didn't work for them, and they quickly found out that the saying, money can't buy you happiness, exists for a reason. The whole time this was going on, the police were watching. Watching their every move, their every expense. Law enforcement immediately noted how, during all of this spending, not once did the brothers mention or attempt to show interest in finding their parents' killers. Police thought that was more than a little odd. Statements from friends of theirs at the time said that the brothers both seemed to grow a sense of humour, if anything, rather than become sad at their parents' deaths. They developed a noticeably morbid sense of humour in particular. One statement from a friend of Eric's said that while deciding what movie to watch one evening, Eric joked, quote, "How about we watch Parenthood or the movie Dad?" unquote, before erupting into laughter. Glenn Stevens, a close friend of Lyle, also fed back similar observations to the police. He said that he asked Lyle how he was doing a couple of days after the murders had occurred. Lyle simply replied with, quote, "I've been waiting so long to be in this position that the transition has come really easily," unquote. Lyle also began acting like a quote-unquote big shot at this time, making it known that he was stepping into his father's shoes now that he was gone. Though it was all an act, Lyle had nothing to be a big shot about. He had no education to brag about, no position of power, no experience, or any kind of impressive job. He just lorded about in nice clothes with a nice car. Carlos Menendez, a cousin of Jose's, later made comments to say that following the deaths of Jose and Kitty, he was tying up a lot of Jose's loose ends and affairs. He found a copy of Jose's last will and testament dated from 1980. It was the version that Eric and Lyle had presented to claim their parents' estate. But Carlos also stated that there was a more recent file saved on Jose's computer, though he had trouble accessing the file. Lyle found out about this and took the computer to an IT expert, paying him handsomely to access the file for him. But the expert couldn't. He said it couldn't be done as the file was corrupted. So Lyle then instructed the IT guy to erase all of the data on the hard drive. Caraco Pictures, it seems, also benefited from Jose's murder. They collected a $50 million payout because of Key Man life insurance policy cover taken out against Jose. However, the $5 million beneficiary element of the policy, which should have been paid out to Eric and Lyle, was invalid because Jose failed to take the necessary physical exam. Such a shame. The first public hint at something being amiss in the case occurred in 1989. A reporter named Robert Rand was aiming to write an article about Jose Menendez. He wanted to write from the angle of a Cuban immigrant success story that sadly ended in tragedy. So he reached out to the brothers for an interview. And in October of 89, Rand sat down with Eric, who went on to describe his dad as funny, driven, but antisocial. Then Eric said this, quote,
"My dad wouldn't want to socialize. He would always stay home. Instead of going to the movies with my friends, I would just stay home with him too. We would even take showers together. So he got this big bathtub, and Lyle, me and my dad would just take showers together. We would do everything together."
On Halloween night, 1989, Dr. Jerome Oziel received a panic phone call from Eric. He said that he needed to talk to him ASAP. Whilst Eric's court-appointed counseling sessions with the doctor had ended a while prior to the murders, Dr. Oziel, after he'd heard about the deaths of Jose and Kitty, had reached out to Eric and offered him further help if he needed it. He ended up providing legal advice, counseling, and financial advice to Eric in the period after the murders. I guess Eric could really have done with a father figure at that time for advice, eh? Whilst Dr. Oziel was extremely kind and supportive, lending so much of his time and wisdom, he did also take the liberty of charging Eric $1,300 per hour for the privilege. Dr. Oziel's office was on Bedford Drive, two blocks over from Rodeo Drive, to give you an idea of the neighborhood. In the afternoon of October 31st, Eric stopped by Dr. Oziel's office unannounced. Oziel shared the office with other doctors, including his own wife. Eric wants more privacy than the office offered, however, so he insisted that the good doctor and he head out for a walk around the block. It was on this walk that Eric admitted everything to the doctor. "It had been eating him up alive," Eric said. Lyle had no idea this was happening. Although, doctor-patient confidentiality, right? Dr. Oziel wasn't the first person that Eric confessed to, however. Eric, it seemed, had also told everything to his scriptwriting partner Craig Signorelli, who said that Eric framed it in a sort of "if I did it" sort of manner. Eric was cracking under the pressure. After returning to Dr. Oziel's office, Eric called Lyle right away, and he hurried straight over. Lyle was enraged at Eric's confession and tried to play the hard man, though this quickly melted away and the brothers talked through it and got very emotional. Witnesses in the office waiting area said that they saw Eric come out crying and then he ran out of the building. Lyle and Dr. Oziel engaged in a heated argument in the office elevator area. Oziel felt that Lyle was threatening him after Lyle ended the conversation with the line, quote, "Stay safe, doctor." This was enough for Oziel to spring into action. He called his wife and told her to take the children and stay at a friend's house as he was now in danger. Instead of joining them, however, Dr. Oziel decided to stay with his mistress, Judeline Smith, who happened to be sitting in the doctor's office waiting area when all of this was going down. Smith lived in the Carthay Circle area of LA, just west of the LA Museum of Art and the La Brea Tar Pits. As a coincidence would have it, she owned and operated an audio-video duplicating company, back when this was a thing. She also sold crystals and greeting cards because, well, LA. Dr. Oziel convinced Eric and Lyle to meet him a second time to discuss things. A brave move, perhaps. When they met, Dr. Oziel informed them that their discussion last time had been captured on tape. It was a lie, however. They hadn't actually been recorded. Dr. Oziel had, however, taped himself describing everything that had happened, although that was essentially useless. But he would record this meeting, which was illegal in the state of California. Eric and his friend Signorelli ended their friendship in early 1990. Eric had suspected Signorelli of talking to the police, which turned out to be true. Police had approached Signorelli and asked him to wear a wire in an attempt to get Eric to confess on tape. The task that police had set him, however, failed miserably, and Eric didn't end up incriminating himself during the conversation. Thus, the recording was entirely useless. Ultimately, Signorelli would go on to soak up the small amount of infamy and cash in on his newfound celebrity that he gained as a minor character in this saga. Again, standard LA. Judeline Smith is quoted as saying that on the Halloween afternoon, she was stood outside Dr. Oziel's office door and overheard the confessions and threats from Eric and Lyle. Allegedly, Smith states, Oziel also shared details with her should anything ever happen to him. Months later, and after the affair between Oziel and Smith began to cool off, Judeline Smith contacted the police herself and told them about the audio tapes and how the Menendez brothers were recorded confessing to the murders. She added that the brothers had also threatened to kill Oziel too, if he reported them, and she also revealed where the shotguns had been purchased. This was enough for the police to take action. They obtained a search warrant to access Dr. Oziel's office and quickly located the tapes. It was very rare for patient tapes to be confiscated by police due to the doctor-patient confidentiality privilege, but this was considered special circumstances. The tapes, however, would not be allowed to be used as evidence during the trial. Additionally, Judeline Smith would go on to accuse Dr. Oziel of manipulating her and dosing her with large amounts of drugs when he counseled her. So I'm guessing the breakup didn't go so well. Smith also claims that Oziel choked her and led her to believe that her life was constantly in danger by the Menendez brothers. Oziel, of course, denied all of these accusations at trial. On March the 8th, 1990, Lyle was arrested by the Beverly Hills Police Department as he was leaving the house on North Elm Drive while driving his brother's Jeep Wrangler. He was with his friend Glenn Stevens at the time of the arrest. Eric was playing in a tennis tournament in Israel at the time, alongside his tennis coach. Eric flew into Miami shortly after and met with his relatives there, including his aunt Marta, who had been staying in LA up until recently. Marta advised him to fly to LA and face the music right away, and he did. Eric called the police and told them that he was flying in from Miami, and the police took no chances, arresting Eric at LAX. The brothers were subsequently held at the LA Manns County Jail on suspicion of murder and were both held without bond. Attorney Leslie Abramson was hired to represent Eric. Abramson had saved a dozen people from death row. In fact, Abramson was known for her no-nonsense and take-no-prisoners tactics. The Los Angeles Times described her as a, quote, 4'11", fire-eating, mud-slinging, nuclear-strength, pain-in-the-legal butt. Abramson was actually at Queens College at the same time as Jose Menendez, so they very likely would have crossed paths, though they did not know one another. Gerald L. Shalef, who also defended the infamous Hillside Strangler, was hired to represent Lyle. Shalef had previously represented Eric in the burglary case in Calabasas. although attorney Jill Lansing replaced him after he later withdrew due to his personal connection to the family. By the summer of 1990, Eric and Lyle were still publicly professing their innocence, but their lawyers knew that wasn't the truth. Abramson put them in touch with forensic psychologist Dr. William Vickery. In the ensuing months, the boys would finally open up. Eric and Lyle revealed a long history of abuse within the family. More so, they would also admit to their participation in the murders with their wider family, before they would hear it on television and in the press. At the time of their arrest, both Lyle and Eric had girlfriends who would both initially support the brothers, although neither would stick around for too long. In the next episode, I'm going to discuss in more detail the crimes and how Eric and Lyle carried them out. I'll talk about the ensuing media circus that surrounded the brothers once the truth emerged. I'll go into detail about both trials, because that's right, there were more than one trial, and also the reasoning they gave for killing their parents. Finally, I'm going to reveal new evidence and why in 2024 there is a newfound and public campaign to free the brothers. Be sure to come back later this week for part two.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.